and drive a bus or something for a year and then decide they like to be an electronic apprentice after all, then we don't usually consider them.
Yes.
But that's not to say that if someone leaves school at 16, goes and becomes a TV service apprentice, say for a year, and then gets made redundant or decides they want to come into telecoms instead, that we wouldn't take someone like that on.
Mm.
But generally speaking, if people haven't followed the system, then they don't usually stand much of a chance of getting into our apprenticeship.
And you have
the
pick of the apprentices in some senses, so you don't you don't have to look around more widely.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it is a pity in a way that the educational system is geared up for people to follow the standard system. And we do have problems in providing day release courses and evening courses, or in allowing people to take those options, day release and evening courses, when, for example, they have left school at 16, become unemployed, come to us through the work experience scheme. We take on something like 40 kids a year.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about that as well.
Here.
Yes.
And many of those find jobs within the company.
Mm.
And a number of them, for example, those who have got A-level maths and perhaps not physics or something, but who have not quite got qualifications enough to go on and do further education, but still slot in because of their inherent technical abilities into, let's say, a test department. Whereas in the days of City and Guilds, we could send those people off to do the standard City and Guilds courses that you had all sorts of people doing. The new Technician Education Council scheme isn't geared for anyone who is outside the standard apprenticeship type of system.
Yes.
And we therefore have tremendous headaches each year in providing or in finding suitable courses for those people to follow.
Mm.
So certainly, I mean, we don't adhere or stick absolutely strictly to the system, you know, leaving school at 16 or staying on to A-levels and so on. But on the whole, we are plugged in to
yes.
the educational setup.
Yes, yes, I see. And what, I mean, what do you feel about, what are your views, and I don't mean your views in principle, I mean your views in practice about taking on girls' school leavers as apprenticeships, given what we know about broken work histories, etc. I mean, does that affect your decisions to take them on, or have you decided to take them on regardless, really?
Well, the problem is that we get far too few applications from girls. And therefore it's a non-problem in the sense that we don't have to weed out girls because we feel that we are taking on too many.
Yes.
They are still such a low proportion that we feel guilty about taking on such a low proportion, and locally we can do something about it and go into
the
local
schools
and preach the message.
Why would you want to take on more girls?
Because I think that they are an untapped proportion or portion of the population. You know, if you look at the proportion of girl engineers, if you look at graduate engineers, for example, then I've got the figure somewhere stuffed away, but it's a disgracefully small proportion of the population compared to any other country.
Mm.
And when the country is short of good engineers, it simply can't afford to discourage girls from going into engineering.
Mm.
But with the 18-year-olds, it's far more difficult because we can't stomp around the country because we just haven't got the resources to do it. I mean, the best we can do is, for example, this summer, one of our girl graduate engineers went off to Loughborough University, where the Engineering Industry Training Board ran one of their so-called Insight courses, where they took 45 girls who are doing A-level maths and physics and who thought they might conceivably want to go into engineering.
Mm.
And these types of courses have been very successful in the past. We sent another of our girl engineers down to Essex University a year ago on the same sort of insight scheme, which had a lot to do also with our Marconi colleagues down in Chelmsford.
Of course, yes.
So we help in those sorts of ways, but it's still a drop in the ocean. One hopes that the 45, you usually find that about 40 of the 45 get very switched on to engineering and go off and read engineering, and hopefully they tell all their, you know, school teachers and friends and people in the years below them at school and so on, that engineering really isn't quite like the national image of it is. But our problem is in attracting enough girls to apply in the first place.
Yes.
I think if anything, I haven't got any figures I can quote here, although every now and then we do a few studies, we probably offer to a higher proportion of girls than we do to boys. But that is because...
At the 18-year-old?
Well, at any level, 16 or 18. But that is almost certainly because the girls have overcome a psychological barrier in the first place in deciding they wanted to go into engineering, and therefore they have got something there from a personality and drive point of view, whereas with boys it's perhaps a bit more natural for them to apply for engineering, so you will get a higher proportion who simply haven't got what it takes, but have simply drifted into it because, you know, it sounded right.
So the girls are usually very highly motivated, are they, for example? Are there any differences between them in terms of how they perform or what kinds of areas they... I'm thinking particularly in the engineering areas rather than the business... I mean, the business accountancy areas is not unusual. Right. It's more interesting to talk about
in the
areas.
Engineering areas. I have to admit that I tend to be a bit divorced from the front end of the day-to-day training of the trainees and people in the development labs, but on the whole, I think that they tend to be above average.
Yes.
But, you know, not all of them. You get those who aren't quite up to it in the same way that you have with other apprentices.
Yes, of course.
But relatively few.
Mm.
And we don't tend to have many problems. I think that it's healthy anyway to have a mix of the sexes as far as possible. On training schemes.
Why is that?
I think that boys simply seem to behave in a slightly more mature fashion, I think, when there's one or two girls around. You know, boys will be boys, but when there's a girl around, they perhaps will simply be a little bit more sensitive.
It's a kind of restraining influence.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think, anyway, the insight that... a girl has is a little different from the insight that the boy has, so it becomes complementary when they're perhaps working on a project or something.
Do you mean the insights in general or particularly?
Yes, I think, you know, insights into problems.
Mm.
I'm not sure I could define it,
yeah.
But I think that women do look at the world in a slightly different way from men.
Mm.
I think, if anything, the problem with girls is that one's general experience is that women aren't quite as assertive as men, and that is probably the reason why there aren't more women in senior positions in this company's management. I don't think that there is any bias against women, but they have to compete on an equal basis, you know, I think that those girls that we do take on tend to have what we require in terms of assertiveness.
Yes.
As well as in terms of technical ability.
Yes.
But they are still a relatively low proportion.
Yes. Yes. I can see that. What happens when they get married or they have kids? Or, I mean, do you hope that happens after they finish their apprenticeship, or do you?
On the whole, it happens after their apprenticeship, but I can remember one young lady who was sponsored by us at the Lancaster Polytechnic in Electrical Electronic Engineering, who did get married partway through her degree course, and insisted that her husband found a job in Coventry so that she could stay with the company.
Mm.
She, in fact, stayed with the company for 2 or 3 years after she graduated, and then I think eventually her husband did find a job elsewhere, and she decided to follow him, and we lost her. But it's not unreasonable to have someone for 2 or 3 years after they graduate. One would prefer them to stay for maybe 4 or 5 years.
Would that be the normal length of time, 4 or 5 years?
It varies a lot. I would say that something like 4 years is quite a decent half-life for graduates that we have trained ourselves. But you find that you get the occasional group for whom the half-life is about 2 years. But
what do you mean by half-life? You mean half?
Right. If you look at the number of graduates that have come out of your training scheme in, say, 1978,
yes,
and how many are still around in 1980,
mm,
what proportion of those are still around?
Yes.
And if it's about half after 2 years, then I'd describe that as a half-life of 2 years. But if one looked at the same group in 1982, and there was, you know, at that time there were half of them around, then I'd say the half-life was more like 4 years.
Yes.
In such a situation.
Yes. Yes, I see. So
the trouble is, see, the statistics of girls that we have trained aren't large enough for it to be statistically significant. To compare them with the others and see whether it is significant in any way, because you really have to compare girls within a particular year, because a particular year's people will experience a good or a bad training officer, or they may get engulfed once they graduate into some sort of industrial relations problems, or feel that salaries are a bit low at a particular stage.
And that can affect a whole group.
That can affect a whole group, you see. So you can't just take girls over many years and compare them with the boys over many years.
Yes, right.
I think you've really...
That would be right.
You've still got far too small a sample.
So all you can do is... I mean, you could... Then one can give impressionistic evidence. I suppose impressionistic evidence is better than nothing. But clearly we would want evidence that's kind of hard and statistically significant.
I can think of another girl who wasn't married. She was an accountant, but she had a boyfriend who got a job down on the South Coast. So we arranged for her to transfer as an accountant to one of the Marconi companies within the GC group down on the South Coast, Portsmouth or something like that. So one can get over that problem sometimes. Sometimes, you know, they do leave altogether. But, I mean, the problem certainly isn't that we feel at the moment that girls' graduation immediately go off and, you know, have babies or follow their husbands elsewhere. It can be a problem. I mean, Sue Cardus, for example, who is an excellent software trainer in our main exchange laboratory, who set up and very successfully ran that software training scheme for arts graduates, has just left us to go and have a baby, you know, which is very sad. And obviously you could say, well, you know, if she was male, that wouldn't happen. But then, you know, males leave and go to other companies.
So from what you're saying, it sounds as though there's an averagely high turnover rate of...
I would say so.
Of both, but perhaps for different reasons. I mean...
That's right.
If men are chasing their careers, I mean, some women will be chasing their careers. I mean, that it wouldn't necessarily mean that the men would stay twice as long, so you don't want to have women, for example.
Right.
What about, I mean, do you have any provisions for, well, does it ever happen that girls leave and then come back on these schemes? Or if they leave.
You mean leave partway through a scheme?
No, I meant having, because of having children.
On the whole, there's not a particularly high proportion of employees who leave and then come back at a later stage.
Mm.
I think that the electronics jobs market at the graduate end is such that people, you know, if they're going to job hop, then they job hop, and they tend to job hop to lots of different companies, or else they stay for a long time.
Mm.
I think that once they've been in the company for 2 or 3 years, they made up their mind which path they're going to pursue.
Mm.
And if you job hop, then you've obviously got to be prepared to move around the country a fair bit. But if you stay, then okay, you can bring up the kids locally and you can settle down into your into the locality and
right.
so on.
But if you're a girl, then what do you do? I mean, if you're having kids, do you then leave the job but you want to stay in the area,
well,
or you've got a husband in the area? Or
the first one I'm aware of, because there's such a small sample, is Sue Cardus. Now, talking to Sue before she went, the chances are that We won't see her for 4 or 5 years, and then she may come down on a come back on a part-time or full-time basis once, you know, one or more kids are you know, packed off to school.
She's still in Coventry, is she?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Her husband is still working in the same area, same development laboratory as an engineer.
Yes. So, I mean, you're not in any kind of situation in which you can either generalise or develop policies to try and... Presumably you'd want to keep the Sukardises of this world.
Very much so. That's right.
But that would mean you, what, be favourable towards them reapplying?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, Sukardis, as soon as Sukardis come back, the happier everyone will be. But, you know,
but you don't keep a job open for her? I mean...
Oh, no, you can't do that. In fact, we've already replaced her with another young lady, Kim Brooks, also looking after the software side of things. So, you know... The reaction obviously hasn't been in that area. Heavens, you know, we can't have another woman in here because...
no, that's
so
interesting,
they put another
yes.
married woman into that job. So, you know, I think that we're a large enough company not to fall flat on our faces because any one individual leaves. So we pick whoever the best individual is to do the job, and if it's male, it's male, if it's female, it's female.
And you take the chances of...
That's right.
...people's careers and that's families right. and so on.
But I think there's an increasing proportion of girls as engineers, if only because of the increasing proportion of work that is software.
Right? Is software becoming a female job, do you think?
It's probably a more female-oriented job than electronics. Hardware design is, but that is because there's so few electronics graduates in this country who are female.
Yes.
And on the software side, you do find a rather high proportion of girls going into computer science and computer studies degrees than you do into electronics degrees. So it's really no more than that.
And your recruitment really reflects those trends which have already happened. In A-levels in universities and polytechnics and so on and so forth. I'd wondered about that because of the ways in which, knowing ex-students that have gone into computing and I have a cousin that, in fact, was trained by Marconi. And I just wondered whether software was an area that was not clearly sexually differentiated or whether it was, you know, it certainly doesn't seem to be becoming overwhelmingly male, does it?
Oh, no. I don't know the figures, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if we still employ a predominance of males in the software areas. But, you know, you may be talking about, say, 20% as a sheer guess.
Yeah.
20% females in software compared to maybe 2% females in hardware. You know, if those were the sort of figures that were turned up, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes.
They could be way out.
And your figures would be like anybody else's on that, probably?
Yes, I wouldn't think that we're much different from anyone else.
Right. Maybe I can ask you a bit more about day release scheme. I mean, day release schemes in the sense that you've talked about the schemes that you have for... all of these... How many of these categories that we've talked about would be staff rather than hourly paid?
The only category which is hourly paid is craft. And until such time as our craft employees become staff employees. I don't know how many years that will be away, but no doubt eventually there'll be a national move that way. And of course, there's, I think, people like Chrysler in Coventry who have been staff, who've had staff conditions for craftsmen for many years now. But while the craft areas are still check, then the apprentices will remain check. But all the others are on staff.
Right. Do you say it's? You think it's just part of a general move for? I mean, a long-term general trend for craft employees to become part of staff. Will that be something that the unions will press for, or will that be something that you will initiate? Or
I don't honestly know. It might be a bit of both.
Is it subject to union negotiation? Which of these, for example, with the what's happened with the creation of all these new technical jobs? I mean, in the sense of whether they've become staff, whether they haven't, what kinds of status they have,
well,
what kinds of grading they have.
Is
that been a problem?
Increase in vacancies has been in areas which have been traditionally staff anyway.
Yeah.
So it hasn't. There simply hasn't been any problem, if you like, in that sense.
And has there been a problem with unions about?
Not that I know
about the introduction.
Not that I know of. I'm not involved in the detailed IR discussions. But I believe, for example, that our charge hands went on to staff in the last year, whereas they used to be on check.
Mm.
Not 100% sure of that fact, but I think that, you know, that shows the way that things might perhaps go. And of course, you can't divorce those sorts of things from national EEF / CSEU negotiations either.
Yes. In that you'll be affected by those agreements.
That's right, while we continue to be part of the EEF.
Are you thinking of leaving the EEF?
No, but I mean, it's always possible, in the same way I think Rolls-Royce have pulled out of the EEF.
Have they?
If you remember, last year, there was quite a lot of aggro with a lot of companies, including this one, more or less reduced to a 3-day week because the CSEU took industrial action.
Yeah.
At the time, I think Rolls-Royce made quite a stand and were disappointed with the support.
That's
from
right,
elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I think Rolls-Royce have pulled out. Again, I don't pretend to be an expert on this, but.
So that could happen.
Anything's possible.
Yes.
I think, you know, I'm certainly not aware of GEC intending to pull out at this stage.
Mm.
But while it's part of the EEF, obviously we are party to the national agreements that are made, which could conceivably include check to staff.
Yes.
I think that's rather unlikely for a long time yet.
Yes, I see.
And that would not just include craft areas, it of course includes all Czech employees, operative
areas. Yes, right. From what you say, it sounds as though your actual numbers of staff are on the up at the moment. I mean, with the...
Ben, are you talking about staff or total employees? Because, in fact, the answer to both is yes.
Both are
the
on
longer,
the up.
Both are on the up. But in the longer term, one would expect to see the total number of staff probably stabilising, and up to a point it already is stabilising. And as electromechanical products increasingly give way to electronics, one would expect a gradual decline in the number of Czech employees, but probably nothing very dramatic overnight, although a lot of our business is very dependent on the post office. And the post office did pull the rug from under our feet in a big way in 1974-75, when they effectively chopped 30% of our business away from us, literally overnight. And it was at that stage that the company reduced its total number of employees from about 30,000 to 20,000.
That was the crucial time,
that
wasn't
was the
it?
Crucial
yes.
time. So, if anything, we have increased our total number of employees from about 19,000 to 20,000 over the last couple of years. But it's not going up very dramatically, it's not going down very dramatically.
Did you say over the last year or the last couple of years?
I think in about 1978, 1978-79, it went down to about 19,000, and it's now up to about 20,000.
And that's accounted for primarily by shifts in increasing staff, is it?
No, it's partly increased staff. For example, we have an extra couple of hundred of apprentices, and maybe another 100 or 200 of extra engineers. But probably more than half is accounted for by more direct Czech employees, reflecting a fairly healthy order book, predominantly from the post office.
So it's really affecting both. I mean, it's, but roughly speaking, stabilising.
That's right. Now, in the longer term, if business remains at the present level in terms of volume, one could expect the labour force to decline, simply because as the product gets more sophisticated, you are producing products which take up a smaller volume, because you know these microprocessors can do more and more,
right,
and integrated circuits can pack more and more on. So what takes up a printed circuit board now can perhaps just be on a tiny little microcircuit chip in, you know, 5 years' time, and that sort of trend will continue. So the future labour force as a whole, you know, what the 20,000 will look like in 5 years' time or in 10 years' time, will depend first of all on what happens to the post office business. And
do you think that's, is that assured, the post office business, do you think, given the creation of British Telecommunications? And
well, it's reasonably assured in that the post office makes a reasonable profit, to say the least, on its business.
Yes.
And it is investing a lot of money in buying equipment from companies like ourselves. But you can't totally divorce the health of the post office or the telecoms side of it from the state of the economy. And on the whole, the information suggests that the demand for telecommunications services is not too susceptible to price increases. So it's unlikely that for the next 10 years or so the post office will drastically reduce their business. If anything, they might significantly increase it, but providing only that they can raise the finance to do it. And I see that the post office are raising their charges by something pretty significant this autumn. And that again is to make sure that they are getting in sufficient finance in order to continue buying lots of equipment from companies like ourselves. But supposing that on the whole if we suppose that the business generated purely by the UK demand for telecommunications goes along a reasonably predictable path, then one could expect the labour force as a whole to start tailing off, but gradually, nothing dramatic, so that you would find an increasing proportion of staff to Czech, if you want to put it that way, or in terms of ex-apprentices and ex-trainees and such like employees in relation to shop floor or production operatives. However, if System X in particular is successful in a number of overseas markets, then the whole picture could be dramatically different.
Because the whole volume of production will expand.
That's right.
Yes.
But again, one of the pressures on getting into overseas markets is that, for example, in New Zealand, we sell a lot of telephones, you know, the actual telephone handsets, but we have to assemble them locally. We send out the kits of parts there, but they are assembled locally. And increasingly, if you want to get into these overseas markets, you've got to assemble locally. So we might get major contracts overseas, but on condition that we manufacture them locally.
Which will not help the Coventry... It'll help your R&D, but it, I mean,
that's
won't, that won't... that won't decline, but your kind of assembly and things would be drastically affected.
Well, it simply means that there wouldn't be any extra business there to counteract the decreasing number of employees that one could reasonably expect to employ.
You say that's already happened in New Zealand. You're having to...
Yes, New Zealand is just one of many countries. You know, Nigeria is another.
Yes.
East Africa another, where telephones themselves are assembled locally, and that's the only way in which we obtain a major chunk of the business that's going.
Does that mean that GEC has subsidiaries there that do the assembly?
Yes.
So it's not it's not, you still have control over the assembly.
That's right.
But you
we have our
labour,
local factories out
but
there.
But you use a different labour force.
That's right. Local labour force.
Is that better or worse from the point of view of GEC as a telecoms, I mean as a company?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that. Maybe in sheer production it's a bit cheaper to assemble it all in one factory where you get the advantages of volume production. But I don't know. I suppose a lot depends on things like shipping costs, or whether it's any cheaper to ship broken down parts than to ship complete parts. And the relative costs of assembly
and cost of labour, and so presumably it's that kind of calculation. I asked you just because I wondered. I know it's kind of not really your job, but I just wondered what that calculation would look like. But I suppose actually one doesn't have much choice. I mean, if to get the contract, it's got to be assembled locally.
If we didn't assemble telephones in New Zealand, I'm sure that we wouldn't be the major supplier of telephones to
in
the
New
Zealand
Post Office. So you have to go along with...
We're the only supplier.
Yes.
We get 5-year contracts at a time, and a year ago we won another 5-year supply agreement.
And then you set up you either buy or set up a subsidiary.
Well, yes, already have a subsidiary in New Zealand, and they simply send out container loads of telephone parts, which are assembled.
And that would be what would normally happen, that if you don't have a subsidiary, you'd create one, would you say, that the assembly is still done by the company?
That's right.
Yes, right.
I think that's a trend that British industry as a whole will have to show increasingly.
Yes.
Well,
it's
better to do that than to sell your patents overseas. And of course, that is one thing that does distinguish British industry from its overseas competitors. We predominantly sell patents, whereas our competitors predominantly buy patents.
Yes, yes. But you're not, I mean, GEC Telecoms is not selling patents, it's hanging on to the patents and the...
Yes, I mean, on the whole, we set up subsidiaries overseas and set up assembly there, and it's big enough to have the oomph to be able to afford to do that.
Yes, yes. So that means that all the development would still
stay here
and indeed stay in Coventry.
Yeah, that's right.